at 1414 Park Avenue, Suite 120, just behind Nobby's. It's open 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. You can find more about the Drunken Dumplings on Facebook, Instagram, and at drunkendumplingchico.com. Drunken Dumpling is where they love food, flavor, and our community. Ask Dr. Gale is also made possible by D.A. Lampe Construction, a proud supporter of KZFR Community Radio in Northern California. For more information, visit dalampeconstruction.com. And Lampe is spelled L-A-M-P-E. So Ask Dr. Gale is on the second Thursday of each month. I'm open to your suggestions for interesting people and topics to interview. Let me tell you a little bit about Wilena. She is 24, Gen Z. Her mother is Russian. Her father is Iranian. They met in Russia, and then they came to New York City when Wilena was just a few months old. So I'm interested in her attitudes, Gen Z, feminism, gender, that kind of thing. So let's see what she has to say.
Start there. Where and when were you born?
I was born in 1997. I'm 24 years old. I was born in Russia, outside St. Petersburg, this little tiny village that nobody has ever heard of. but I came here when I was 9 months old, so I don't really know anything about Russia.
But are you bilingual, so you spoke Russian at home?
Yes, I spoke Russian at home. I also spoke English, I spoke Spanish, I learned Latin along the way, so yeah, four languages.
Wow, that's great. What month were you born? I'm interested in your astrological sign.
I was born on March 8th, which is International Women's Day. It's very appropriate for me.
Right. So is that Pisces?
Yeah.
And do you feel like a sensitive, sometimes indecisive, intuitive kind of person or not?
It's interesting. I've been giving astrological signs a lot of thought lately, and before I used to never believe in them because it just I've always been introduced to things like science, and I've always been surrounded and immersed in science, so that's what I'm always going by. But lately I've been questioning that a lot, because I think that there must be some validity to astrology, right? It's something that's been around for generations, for centuries, so I don't want to dismiss it so easily. I'm definitely not indecisive, that's what I'm gonna say, but I am intuitive, so I don't know if that means that, I don't know, I have parts of me that are my rising, whatever. I've heard that, but I don't know what my rising is, so I can't speak quite intelligently on this.
There's a free site called Astrolabe, A-S-T-R-O-L-A-B-E, and they'll do a printout of like 20 pages of your natal chart. And, you know, it's not like having an astrologer do it, but that'll tell you the basics, that's for sure.
Yeah, I heard for those things you have to know what time you were born. When I asked my mom, like, I don't know, maybe she was traumatized by the birthing experience because it was a really difficult process. It was a long labor. I know that I was born sometime in the middle of the night, like between 12 and 2, maybe 12 and 3. But I don't think I ever got a specific time from my mom. I have to work on that.
Mm-hmm. A good astrologer can figure out by major events in your life which is more accurate. Why did your parents leave their small village?
I guess turmoil, right? Anyone who flees Russia is usually fleeing from turmoil. Well, anyone who flees from any country like Russia is fleeing from turmoil, usually. My dad is Iranian and my mom is Russian, so it's interesting. My dad's family was born in Iran, but they all moved to Russia. So that's where my parents met. And my dad makes this joke about how since I was born on International Women's Day, if we had stayed in Russia, then all I would receive on my birthday are flowers. And I wouldn't be happy about that. So that's the reason that he claims that we came to New York. Clearly that's not the real reason, but my parents and I, we don't have substantial discussions like that where we reveal our feelings and reveal the reasons that way you do things, I guess. So I hesitate to ask them, and I probably will in the future because I'm curious about why they left, genuinely curious about why they left. But right now we're not in the state where we have those, have anything besides superficial surface level discussions.
Hmm. Do you have siblings?
I do, yeah. A younger brother. He is 20 years old. He was born here, so he's 100% American. He can be president if he wants to. I cannot be, unfortunately. But he doesn't want to be president, so it doesn't even matter.
Okay. A lot of times, firstborn girls are achievers. I did a book on climate, young women activists globally, and a lot of them, I think like two-thirds, were firstborn. So it's not... not statistically probable. So I think firstborns do get encouragement to lead and achieve and move forward. Does that fit for your experience?
I think so, yes. My parents were not quite strict with me, but I always wanted to achieve at school. I always wanted to achieve in extracurricular activities. So that was something that I was always just driven to do. My parents supported me in doing that. I remember coming home from school all the time and jumping right into my homework, and I wouldn't do anything until I was finished with it. My brother is not that way at all. I don't want to say, well, I don't really know why he's like that, but he definitely got treated differently than I did growing up. My parents were a lot stricter with me with things like coming home late or dating, for example. My brother doesn't have any of that inhibiting him. He gets to do whatever he wants.
Right. I'm finishing up a book about masculinity and men's views about masculinity. And that theme of treating boys differently than girls, socializing them differently, is really interesting. And what comes up over and over in those discussions with men is boys are taught not to be vulnerable, not to show their weaknesses or their deep feelings. And then the amazing thing is then we expect them to be in relationships in their adulthood and have these communicative, deep exchanges when we've kind of drummed it out of them. Do you see that in your brother?
Absolutely, I do. We started having more heartfelt discussions in the last year or two. I think that he's matured more since he's 20 years old now. He still has a little bit to go. I have this dream of going out to dinner with him and being able to talk about our parents or just like talk about my life, my dating life, these very personal things that I can't really share with other people in my family. My brother, I feel like I can share that with him, but he has a little bit of learning to do. So sometimes I view that as my role, like I'm his teacher, but that's kind of a weird dynamic because I really want to be his friend more so than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I do. I definitely see that. He has a girlfriend. His girlfriend's lovely. She usually teaches him. and she's younger than him, so it's quite interesting. I see that a lot in my brother. But I think that he's making a huge effort to learn, to be receptive to my feelings and to the feelings of people around him and what they're telling him. He's interesting, to say the least.
Good. Is he in college?
He actually is going to trade school in January for electrical engineering.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. I'm excited for him. He's very, very excited. He decided that sitting in a classroom was not for him. He didn't like it at all, so he would rather do more hands-on things.
You know, that's part of a piece that explains why currently women are 60% of the college students in the U.S. And so that seems to be a part of it. Economically, boys think, I don't want to sit at a desk like your brother, and I can make a lot of money doing something else, so why not?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I don't really know why so many women are going into college at higher rates or completing college at higher rates, but I like hearing that out of, for selfish reasons. I like hearing that there's this wave on TikTok where women and girls are trying to explain why they use words like as opposed to men and boys who do not use words like. And they're showing that they're trying to assert themselves in conversations and indicate that they're not done speaking. It's like a development that comes after generations of women and girls just being interrupted by men continuously. So it's like a coping mechanism.
Huh.
And I admit that I've tried to cut out my likes before in the past. I've tried to speak more assertively.
Directly.
And I've succeeded. Yes, I've succeeded. I have eliminated the likes out of my everyday speech for the most part, but there are times when I still rely on them, and I don't really think that the fact that I use likes in my speech, it doesn't indicate that I'm not an intellectual human being, because the ideas that are coming out of my mouth, I think, are smart and strong and well-formed. And just because I'm incorporating a like or two in there, it doesn't negate any of that. So I don't know, if someone is choosing to focus on one word like as opposed to a whole string of words or a whole sentence even, then what does that really say about them, right?
If someone said to me, I'm like totally in love with some movie star, that does sound Valley Girl and teen. I'm like totally this and like totally. Is that the kind of like use you mean?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
That shouldn't negate what the person is saying. That doesn't mean that the person's feelings or ideas aren't valid. Usually they are.
Right. What did you learn from your family growing up about what it was to be a good woman? I'm thinking in Iran, people are traditionally Islamic. In Russia, they're traditionally Russian Orthodox Church. Were there those kind of influences, or what was the message?
Sort of. My mom, I think she's a feminist, but I don't think that she would call herself a feminist. She came here when she was 25. She learned the English language at around that time, too. So she knows the definition of the word feminist because I talk about it, but it's not something that she would have encountered naturally while learning the English language. So I guess she, in my head, when I talk about feminism, I can see that she understands what I'm fighting for, but I don't think she feels it the same way that I do because of her upbringing and her background. So she is a feminist in the sense that she believes wholeheartedly in her agency, in her ability, in her right to live fully and belong as a woman. So I have been influenced by her in that regard to think about womanhood that way, but I've also been influenced by a number of other things, like books. Books in particular, I've learned so much from books. Fiction with strong female characters written by women. I've just been reading books all my life, and parts of those characters have sort of meshed with my own personality, like Hermione Granger with her intelligence, Jane Eyre with her defiance, Madame Defarge with her ruthlessness and anger. All of these characters are just a part of me today. So I've learned from my mom, I've learned from my schooling, I've learned from books, I've learned from my friends. I'm still learning.
Right, of course, it's lifelong. And what about your dad having supposedly Islamic Muslim beliefs?
Well, actually, my family is kind of complex. So my mom is half Muslim, half Christian, and my dad is Jewish.
So,
there we go. But in the Jewish religion, there are still elements of patriarchy and sexism that resonate. So those are parts that I fight against, and those are parts that I lose at. When it comes to my family, which is part of the reason why we don't have super substantial conversations.
If you're just joining us, this is KZFR 90.1 FM, Ask Dr. Gail. We're listening to an interview that I did with a New York City Gen Z reporter, feminist, and I welcome your suggestions for topics. You can email me at gkimball, G-K-I-M-B-A-L-L, at csuchico.edu. Thanks for listening, and let me know what you think about Elena.
Sabbath observance on Friday or that kind of thing.
No, I remember this one time I was a child, maybe like 10 or 11, and suddenly we celebrated the Sabbath. We observed the Sabbath, and I was so confused because I've never done that before in my life. So, no, it's a rarity. I'm not even sure why we did it that day.
Interesting. What about school? I interviewed a young woman in New York named Andy, and she said she's maybe a year younger than you, and she said growing up, it was clear that the teachers didn't like the boys, the students. They thought of them as troublemakers. And her friends said, I hate boys, unless they were going out with one. I wondered what you saw in terms of attitudes from educators towards boys and girls.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I never even thought about that. In college, I remember, so when I graduated from college, I participated in a forum because I was a triple major, English, political science, journalism. And this was a forum of...
That was in 2019, right?
2019, June 20, May 2019. And it was this forum where all of the professors of the political science department invited some alums and students to participate in their experiences, share their experiences about what it meant to be a political science student at Brook College, which is part of the City University of New York. So I remember talking to them about how in every single political science class that I've taken at Brook College, and that was, I think, around 30 or maybe 35 credits, something like that. It was a typical, you know, typical major. In every single political science class that I've taken there, most, maybe like 90, 95% of the readings that we were assigned for homework or the readings that we analyzed in class, they were written by men. So I made that point, and I was asking them to consider why we aren't reading political scientists who are women. And I think most of the professors were receptive to that comment, but then I also felt that some professors were not receptive, and they said something to the lines of, well, that's the canon, and that's what we have to work with. And I kind of find that hard to believe. Like, are there really no political scientists who are women who've made a dent, who've made an impact, who have something worthwhile to say? I find it very, very hard to believe. So there are things like that in the course of my education that I still feel like I'm defending as a woman who's trying to get the most out of her education. So my political science education is formed largely by the opinions and thoughts of men, and I'm trying to change that on my own right now. And I'm not going to school for that. I go to school for women's and gender studies as a master's student now, so it's just up to me, I feel, to change it in myself.
What about in secondary school? You didn't have that sense that teachers favored one gender over the other?
I remember my teachers telling me that boys behave differently than girls, for example. But they had the opinion that boys were less mature, for example, and I also had that opinion. Because that's just something that I either observed growing up, because boys were over here making fart noises or making jokes about sex, and I'm just here with my head buried down in my notebook and I'm doing well. I was a straight-A student. I always was a straight-A student, so that's where my concentration was. But meanwhile, you have this boy who's like in the eighth grade just doing some shenanigans next to me and distracting me from my work. So I can see where the teachers got that perception. In private conversations, especially with my female teachers, I remember them saying something to me like, you're doing really well. I hope the boys are not distracting you. These boys are very mature, but don't tell them that I said that. Things like that.
Yeah. Well, developmentally, they are, people say, like a couple years behind. So they do develop more slowly.
That's true, but nobody ever really says to boys that they should look up to girls as role models for that, right? We always say that, we always give boys the excuse that they mature slower, so we have to make exceptions for that.
Good point. When did you start thinking, I'm a feminist, and use that word?
Pretty early on. I remember, I don't really know when feminism was popular, but I feel like when I was in the beginning stages of my high school career, 14 years old, it wasn't a popular word to use. I remember getting glances and glares if I called myself a feminist. But I remember doing it because
it meant man-hater to a lot of people.
It still means man-hater to a lot of people, and I find myself defending the word feminism, even to my dad. But as long as I can remember, I guess. I'm not even sure in middle school if I did, but I feel like I definitely acted like a feminist, even if I didn't call myself a feminist. But I think the earliest memory I have is when I'm 14 or 15 years old and I'm just editing a literary magazine for school, for high school, and the word feminism pops up in a poem or in a short story or something, some kind of submission that we got, and I felt it. It resonated with me. Yeah. I'm trying to think of a more concrete example for you, but I really, that's the time that I just remember from before.
Right. And then why did you decide to get a master's in women's and gender studies?
I love learning. And once I graduated with my bachelor's degree, I took a gap year, I guess you would call it. Well, I didn't intend to get a master's at all. I just intended to finish my schooling because I was going into journalism, and the option for journalists to get a master's was J school. And I'm not interested in that because I had plenty of experience under my belt in my undergraduate career with internships at major news outlets and also with freelance gigs with the school newspaper, I was a top journalism student, so I didn't feel like I needed a master's degree to reiterate the experience that I've already gotten exposure to. But then I started thinking about being in the classroom again. I missed interacting with classmates. I missed bopping ideas off of each other. I really missed feeling that expansion whenever you get taught this new concept or get introduced to this new part of the world that you've never really thought about before. And I made an effort to go after that feeling, and I ended up applying to CUNY. And I'm a public school product. Like, I've been in public school all my life in New York City, so I wouldn't really go anywhere else but CUNY because CUNY's mission really resonates with me. So that's what I did. I looked at the programs that CUNY was offering, and I thought very critically about which ones I would go to. I thought I considered comparative literature, but it didn't feel right. I considered political science, but again, didn't feel right. But then I saw women's and gender studies all the way at the bottom of the list because it's the very last program that's listed alphabetically. And it hit me that's what I'm covering in my line of work. That's how I identify as a human being with feminism. So maybe I should explore that part of me more.
And how many women's studies were you able courses to take as an undergrad?
One.
Like an intro?
Yes, and it wasn't even labeled a women's studies course. It was labeled something else. It was labeled...
gender studies?
No, it had no indication that it would be about gender or anything. But the content that we read was about gender and about these ideas of what it means to be a woman and feminism and these movements. So, but it wasn't called, I don't remember what it was called. It was masquerading as another course, but it was definitely a gender studies course.
Interesting. Are there any courses in the gender studies program that are focused on masculinities?
There are general courses on what it means to be a feminist and what it means to focus on gender, for example, that incorporate masculinity.
But do they really?
To an extent. Like, you know how a lot of courses have, like, Race Week, for example, where you're talking about, like, black women, for example, in feminism, as opposed to just interspersing black women throughout the entire course. That's kind of what they do with masculinity as well. They dedicate like a week, like it's a theme or a topic, as opposed to, you know, something that's integral to the entire discussion. So they do that. But there are definitely conversations in academic circles about focusing on masculinity and offering courses specific to masculinity. There's a listserv that I'm a part of there, where there's like this ongoing discussion from academics and scholarly experts who are talking about masculinity and trying to design a course to accommodate it. So it's definitely coming, is my
What's the title of that listserv?
Let me look it up for you. So, masculinity.
So you are listening to KZFR 90.1 FM. Thanks for listening. This is Ask Dr. Gail show. Gail Kimball speaking. We're listening to a reporter from New York City, a 24-year-old young woman, Gen Z. Let me know what you think. My email is gkimball@csuchico.edu. Let's go back to Yelena.
People for if they know of any men's studies classes.
Michael J. Murphy was the one the most recent one that I have.
Okay, I'll look. So what are you going to focus on in your, do you do a thesis or a comprehensive exam, or what do you do?
Yes, we do a thesis at the end of the program, I guess. I'm a bad student in the sense that I have not formed my topic on it yet. I'm in progress with it, but I really want to focus on media representation because that's what I focus on as a master's student. That's what I think a lot about. Gendered language is a big issue in the media, the way that news outlets regard women, people who identify as LGBT. It's just, it's a mess, and there's a lot of change to be done, and journalism in general is heading toward the state of progression where it evolves and it tries to be more inclusive, but there's still so many holes to fill that I feel like are not talked about as often as, say, things like, I don't know, like race coverage or how to think about journalism ethically. Like, those discussions are they're not focusing on race. I mean, they're not focusing on gender. They're not focusing on sexuality, and they should be. And that's a big hole. So that's what I'm hoping to focus on in my master's thesis somehow. More specifics to be determined.
I have an idea for you. You know about the Gina Davis Center, the research center, right?
Yeah.
The group called Promundo, P-R-O-M-U-N-D-O, is working with the Gina Davis Center to get the word out about the need for boys and men to work for gender equality.
Yeah.
And they've done something like 3 survey studies with them. So I think there's probably lots of interesting data there, and I can get you in touch with the co-founder of Promundo. He's in D.C. right now.
That's great, because men should absolutely be involved in these discussions, and it's kind of seldom that they are, right? In my circles, at least, men do identify as feminists, which is really, I like that, but in a lot of circles, I don't think they do. There's a lot of power in men aligning themselves with feminism, right? Because they're using a feminine-sounding word to describe themselves, and in doing so, they're what, like challenging what it means to be a man, stretching the definition of masculinity. Those are important.
What percent of your fellow sister students are male, female, non-binary, questioning whatever their orientation is?
I think a good 90% of the women's and gender studies program at CUNY is women, cis women. And I think the rest of the 10%, by my estimations at least, I didn't conduct any formal analysis or anything, but by my estimations, about the rest of them, 10%, non-binary and cis men.
And what about GLBTQ identified people?
I would say from my conversations, my informal conversations with them and what I know about them through class discussions and in hangouts, 60% of them, 70% of them, a majority of them identify as LGBT.
Mm-hmm.
Myself included.
And where are you on the lesbian, non-binary? What category do you put yourself in?
I don't like categories. If I have to, on my Tinder, it says bisexual and queer. It says that because I have to select categories for that. But it feels weird to me to say that. And part of the reason is because I try to explain this all the time to my LGBT friends who sometimes say that I'm doing a disservice by not identifying myself. I identify myself in the moments when I feel it is important, you know, to make a stand, to include yourself as part of the community in a very public way. I'm fine with that. But when you think about it, the words just sound weird to me, like lesbian, gay, bisexual. They just, you know how in English, the words that we use, the sound of them mimics their connotation? Like the word, take the word slow. Like it's the long O in slow, it sounds slow. So the fact that you're saying it, it tells you that there is something, it makes you feel that there is a slowness to it. So it mimics the connotation of the word. But lesbian, bisexual, gay, it just sounds like science-y and proby, and it just sounds really, really weird to me. So, I mean, straight. Straight is like a very, it has a different connotation than the word lesbian and gay. And I really don't know how to explain this in a very eloquent way, but those are my feelings. Like, it just sounds scientific and like you are scrutinizing something and the words are clunky and odd. So it just sounds weird to me to say, I'm bisexual or I'm queer. But if I have to, when I have to, I do that.
So in terms of your relationships over your dating history, have you been more involved with cis men or cis women?
Both. I think it's about half and half. The dating scene, I don't know, it's kind of weird. I'm straight passing, whatever that means, you know, straight passing in quotes. Whenever I go on dates with women, I meet them mostly online, and multiple women have told me that they would never hit on me in a bar, for example, because I don't appear to be gay or appear to be lesbian. I'm just like, what does that even mean? Like, so many lesbian women have told me that they don't peg me as a gay woman, which infuriates me. They talk about things like markers, like I don't have any markers of a gay identity or lesbian or bisexual identity. So that infuriates me. One time I went on a date, we were playing pool, and she told me that the only marker of mine that I have is that I wear rings, and you can see them here. I wear different kinds of rings, but these are just what I'm wearing right now. And she said, those are the only way that people can know that I'm gay. And I'm like, what do you want me to do? Like, I don't understand. Do you want me to, like, wear rainbows? Do you want me to, like, tattoo that I'm gay or that? It infuriates me that there's, like, an appropriate way to look gay or look lesbian or bisexual. Just look not straight, right? It's weird.
Well, in the olden days, they used to say there were lipstick lesbians and butch lesbians, and you could really look and see, oh, this woman has really short hair and wears a leather jacket and rides a motorcycle, and this woman has lipstick and longer hair. It kind of made things easier in a way. You did have those markers.
Sure, but I feel like the definition of sexuality has expanded since then, right? We talk about sexuality as something that we identify as now, not as what we look like or what we appear to be. So I don't know. Whatever it means to be straight passing, apparently I'm it. And it really angers me, but that's what my life is like in terms of dating.
Right. It would be easier. You just cut your hair real short and have a butch haircut, and then you'd have the marker.
Yeah, but I don't want to do that. I like my hair. I like my earrings. I like dresses. I'm not wearing anything elaborate right now, but I wear masculine clothing too. I alternate. I wear whatever feels good to me. I do whatever I want with my appearance, and that's all it is. It has nothing to do with who I'm attracted to. It's what I want to wear.
And that's really the whole point, isn't it? That it's about fluidity and preference and choice and not about stereotypes or boxes.
Yeah, but I feel like still a lot of people resort to stereotypes and boxes, even in the LGBT community.
Interesting. In your coursework, I know that for decades there's been a big emphasis on intersectionality, intersectionality, intersectionality. That gets repeated a lot. We're not just women. We have class and religion and skin color. What other themes are you hearing being emphasized by your profs?
Nationality. Nationality is a big one that's been added in the last, well, at least in the course of my educational career. We talk about where people come from, colonial pasts, imperialist pasts, all of these histories that are intertwined with our conversations about race, about gender, about sexuality. Nationality still takes a big role in that as well. We read different materials that put nationality at the center of feminist discussions.
So for you, the fact that you have this Iranian, Russian, American influences, that would have to be considered in understanding you?
I don't know, because like I said, I left Russia when I was 9 months old. I haven't been back. I don't know anything about Russia. If you were to plop me in the middle of it, I would be able to speak the language and find my way around, but like, that's a testament to my parents teaching me the language, not a testament to me being immersed in the culture. I'm an American. I've never been to Iran. I don't plan on going to Iran. The Iranian and Russian parts are big parts of my cultural upbringing at home, but beyond the home, they don't really go anywhere. I don't see them anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the gender, feminist, whatever, books, texts that you've read that really had an impact on you? You mentioned some fiction has really been influential. What else?
There are so many. There's this book called Moan, and it is exactly what you think it is. It's about the female orgasm.
Oh.
Who wrote it? Well, it wasn't so much an author as a person who gathered a series of anonymous essays. So this person reached out to, I don't remember the author's name, Ellie Honig, maybe? But this person reached out to a bunch of people on, I don't know, in their network or on a listserv, or maybe, I don't know, in a Facebook group or something. And she asked them to write about their experiences with orgasms, with their own orgasms, with women's orgasms. And it can be read as a guide to the female orgasm. There are maybe like 50 or 60 essays in this collection, and a lot of them talk about how to make them have an orgasm specifically. A lot of them talk about how they view orgasms, how they view their vagina, their relationship to their vagina. And it's a brilliant book that makes me feel a lot of things, because the way that it's written is beautiful. There are things in there that I have been shy to talk about in the past, for example, that were kind of revelatory for me, that kind of inspired me to take control of my sexual activities, my sexual experiences, to own them. And I'm still learning from them. I'm still young, and I'm still learning from those experiences and building on them. But that was a very, very influential book for me. There's this book called The Myth of the Nice Girl. Don't remember her. The author, Frances, I think, something. It's a bright yellow book, so you can't miss it. It's a bright yellow book. It's a beautiful, beautiful yellow. Yellow's my favorite color. And it's about how to acclimate in the workplace and how to be in a professional space without sacrificing your values, without sacrificing, without thinking about your likability factor, for example. And it's a very easy to read how-to book, essentially. So those kinds of books are really high on my radar. I don't want to say things like The Second Sex or, I don't know, all of these books that are in the canon for feminist literature, because I've only read parts of them. Nobody I know has ever read the entire thing. The book is like a brick, so I haven't read the entire thing. It's on my library, though. I've read parts of it. I'm fine with it. I like the ideas behind it, but I feel like they're part of a different wave of feminism that no longer really applies or has been adapted, I guess. So, yeah, those are foundational texts that I have in my mind somewhere, but they're not the go-to texts when I think about feminism. The go-to texts when I think about feminism are the ones that I mentioned and the ones like them.
I'm thinking in terms of Moan, that Cher Height's book, The Height Report, I think it made tremendous changes for women when she said that like 70% of women need direct clitoral stimulation to have an orgasm, and vaginal orgasm is somehow supposed to be the way women have orgasms, but most don't, which is really a political issue. Was there anything that was revelatory in Moan in terms of women's sexuality like that?
I guess, right? There are stories and essays in there about submission. And submission is a big thing. Sometimes I consider myself a switch. So I go between. And I'm comfortable going between depending on the context, being dominant or being submissive. I'm comfortable being either or a combination of them, whatever. It doesn't matter. It really depends on the context, who I'm with, how I'm feeling, like all these different factors. But I've never been one to be like 100% fully submissive. So there are essays like that on submission in Moan that I find very revelatory. The fact that women do enjoy these things is very interesting to me, and I'm not sure if I don't enjoy it because I have this preconceived notion of what it means to be a feminist or what it means to be a woman today, or if I just genuinely don't enjoy it because for whatever reason, right? So it's kind of hard to separate the two. But those stories, I'm reading them, and they're fascinating to me. They're fascinating to me. There are stories of how these women want to be, you know, tossed around, or they want to be held down so that they can't really like do anything. They can't touch themselves. They can't touch their partner. It's just really, really interesting to me. I wonder what it would be like to be in that context. And I'll try it. It inspires me to try it. But I've never done like a total submission before.
I was in a woman's group, and this woman said that her husband and she do a thing where they tie her wrists to the bedposts. So yeah. It's kind of like a bondage thing. So I told my significant other about it, and we tried it, and I got the giggles. I mean, it wasn't comfortable with it, so I just giggled and giggled, and it totally turned him off. So that did not work for us. But you're right. People have their own proclivities that are their own way of being, that have integrity for them. Yeah. In The Myth of the Nice Girl, what have you seen in your work in news media and in business organizations where you've done internships and worked for them? What could you apply to Myth of the Nice Girl that you might not have noticed if you hadn't read that book?
I feel like there's a lot I could apply. And I feel like I have been. I read it maybe 2 or 3 years ago, and it's just one of those books that kind of lives in the back of my head where in like a weird space where I don't actively pull it up. Like, I don't know where anything is on the book. Like, I can't quote anything from the book, but the ideas have stuck with me, right? That's what books do. They just kind of make you feel things, and the feelings really stick with you. So when I think of the myth of the nice girl today, I think about feelings of power and feelings of trying to appeal to that power, my own power, but also power of the people who are working with me, right? Working alongside me and finding ways to make that power work. And one of the things in the myth of the nice girl that I remember taking, right, because nobody is going to do it for me. And as much as it sucks that I'm probably the only person who is thinking about power dynamics in those situations, I do have the power to change them and shift them. And if I do have that power, then I'm going to take it. So I don't know. There are a lot of issues in media and journalism, and it's not a secret. Journalism is flawed. As much as we journalists want to believe that it's not flawed and that it's a vital part of democracy, we can do better, and there are so many ways that we can do better. But in discussions with top leadership, top male leadership at my organizations, I do challenge sexist notions, for example. I do challenge notions where I feel like the coverage that we're putting out is unethical, and that creates power disparities that puts me in a position where I, a young 24-year-old reporter, am going up against, I don't know, an editor, a male editor who is twice my age, maybe three times my age, who makes maybe five or six times more than me. So it's a scary situation to be in, but if I don't say anything, I just feel guilty about it after. So I don't know. Most of the time it's driven by my belief that what I have to say is important, and that there are probably other people who are thinking the same thing but don't want to speak up because of the power dynamic. So that's what I got from The Myth of the Nice Girl. That's what was emphasized in me from that book.
Well, can you think of a specific example where you did speak truth to power, and what happened?
Are you familiar with that Gabby Petito case?
Is that the rape on the pool table?
No, Gabby Petito is the girl, the 22-year-old or 21-year-old girl who went missing. She went on a trip with her boyfriend. She went missing.
Oh, right, from Florida. Yeah. And he killed her. Yeah, right.
So I got really upset with my news organization because we published dozens of articles on Gabby Petito. We turned everything into a separate post, a separate article. Every single little detail, we just put it into a separate article, which is crazy to me because we're really like amplifying, we're kind of milking it because it was doing really well with our audience. It was getting high traffic, it was getting a lot of clicks, it was getting a lot of engagement. So we were milking it. Like we were, and I wrote a few of those articles, but then after a while, I started to feel really, really uncomfortable writing them and thinking about them because we were centering this girl. And I remember talking to a source. I remember talking to one of the neighbors of Brian, her boyfriend Brian's neighbors, and they were talking about Gabby as if she was, you know, America's sweetheart. They used those words, those exact words, like America's sweetheart or something. She's America's angel. One of those very, they loved her basically, and they characterized her in this way that made her seem that she was like representative of every single girl in the United States.
Because she's white and blue eyes and blonde. So if she'd been the Native American woman of color,
Exactly. So I brought that point up to top leadership, and then they said that while this is valid, they're also using this opportunity to put out coverage about Native American women who are missing. But that didn't sit well with me either because I made the argument that, well, yes, we're doing that, but that's secondhand. That's an idea that's coming to us as a result of the idea of Gabby Petito. It's not one that we would have prioritized if Gabby Petito didn't exist. So that's not a really sufficient explanation for me. So I've been pushing back throughout the entirety of the Gabby Petito saga for like however long it lasted, like a month and a half. And eventually I just stopped writing articles about it. I refused assignments, and I was like, I'm not putting my name on that. Like, I don't feel comfortable with it. I went all the way up to the editor-in-chief, and I spoke to him in a private session. Like I said, I'm a lone reporter going up against this, so sometimes I feel powerless, but I don't know. I guess I can find solace in the fact that I'm doing something, even though that doesn't really bring me great comfort.
Yeah. Sometimes young women in the workplace get patronized. They get treated like my little sweetheart or my little daughter substitute, or isn't she cute? Do you find that kind of attitude or not?
Yeah, I do. But more so, I think I find that there's a condescending attitude. And I don't want to name any names, but I've had male editors come up to me and they were very condescending to me. I remember I was being harassed, like horribly, horribly harassed by internet trolls because of this article that I put out. And I don't want to give too many details because I feel like if I give too many details, it will, you know, have repercussions for me professionally. So I put out this article, and the article attracted an array of far-right conservatives and one prominent conservative orator. He highlighted my article and he doxed me, and it turned into a horrid month of harassment, and my face got plastered. Like, my face, my images from Google, they got plastered on naked bodies of women on sites like 4chan and 8chan. And it was just a month of mental health crises. And I remember a really high-level editor at the organization that I was working at the time, he called me up because I was making a splash, like an insider. And the company's name was making a splash. So it made it really, really difficult for me to work and have good mental health while working. So I took a lot of time off from work, but I got a call from the top-level editor, and he was saying something like, well, you know, you kind of instigated this yourself. And I was like, what do you mean? Like, I'm the person getting harassed. And I thought that this phone call would be you trying to consult me and you trying to tell me that we have support for you. But no, this turned into something completely different. So then the next day, he talked to one of my female editors and said, well, I hope she didn't take offense to that call. And I was like, okay, well, I did. And then I told that to my female editor, and my female editor was like, well, she told the top level editor that he should apologize to me. And he didn't apologize to me. He apologized to the female editor for appearing to make me upset, and he doesn't know why I'm upset, and he hopes that I'm not upset and all these things. And I'm like, okay, well, great. That doesn't help me, but...
No, it's a you message kind of disguised. You're obviously too emotional or something.
Yeah, like, it's my fault. Yeah. I'm like, I'm not the one. I'm getting emails and texts, and I'm being doxxed, and my Twitter is blowing up. Like, how is this my fault? Like, I'm not here asking for anything. So that's happened before. They've gotten better about it, but yeah.
When I was getting tenure and promotion, we read books about dress for success, and that, you know, you should dress in a certain way so you're seen as professional and taken seriously. Do you, you know, if someone goes to work with a low-cut blouse and you know, yoga pants on, do you think they should have the right to do that, or do you think that that it's not wise?
No, absolutely. I think you should have the right to do that. And I'm guilty of that. I do that a lot. So, you know, we've been remote for a while, but I'm wearing a crop top right now. I'm wearing sweatpants. You can see it. I'm just wearing it. So this is something that I would wear to work. If I were in person, it shouldn't have any bearing on what kind of ideas come out of my mouth. My brain is separate from my body. Like, they work in connection, but my brain has its own ideas. It has its own, it's capable of manifesting its own thoughts. So what's in my brain is not reflective of what's on my body. That's the same. It's the same concept as the markers, right? Like, markers of professionalism, markers of straightness or gayness. It's the same thing. Those markers don't really exist. They're just manifestations of what we believe should exist, but they don't have any validity. They're not real. Like, the fact that I'm wearing this does not mean that I will do less stellar work in my professional career.
Right. That's a consistent theme. That makes sense. Some people find that the concept of waves, feminist waves, first, second, third, fourth, are useful. Do you think they are? And if so, are we in a fourth wave? Or are we in the fifth wave? So let's say first wave is suffrage, second wave is Betty Friedan, feminine mystique, now make legal changes. Third wave is intersectionality. Fourth wave, emphasis on media, internet, activism. Do you think the way I summarize it is accurate, and where do you think we are now?
I think it's a hard conversation. I think it's a hard question to answer because the waves kind of blend into each other, right? So it's kind of hard to pick, it's kind of hard to pinpoint a specific year, for example, when first wave feminism ended and transitioned into second wave feminism. There's no, you can't neatly separate it like that. So in my head, it's not really useful to categorize it like that. I understand why we do it, because there are some distinctions that we need to be aware of. But at the end of the day, feminism is about evolution and transition, and that's what it's doing. I mean, we don't, do we, I find it kind of difficult because I can't think of another example, another concept that we categorize like this, right? That we view as waves like this, like sexuality, racism, capitalism, like all these structures. We don't really have waves to describe them. We recognize that they're evolutions and that they ebb and flow like every other structure out there. So why don't we do the same for feminism? I mean, granted, I do think that we are, if we have to categorize it, we are in a different wave of feminism. I'm not sure if it's the fourth wave or if it's the fifth wave, because I think that part of the evolution of feminism today is that it's being, that a lot of it is being led by really young Gen Z activists. Gen Z meaning people who were born in like 97 and after. I was born in 97, so I'm Gen Z. So I feel like my feminism may be different, for example, from a millennial's feminism who might still be inclined to, I don't know, look for marriage, look for a relationship that culminates in a marriage. I'm not, I don't think I'm going to get married. I don't see a benefit for it. And I know that a lot of Gen Z, young Gen Z women also think like me, and maybe that's some kind of pattern that's forming. But it just seems like we might be entering a completely different wave than fourth at this point. I can't say conclusively, but that's what it feels like. It feels like a different wave.
And how? What would distinguish it besides not looking for traditional institutions like marriage?
Home ownership, maybe.
Not having home ownership?
Yeah, not having home ownership. The ways that we regard our work, for example. I believe that millennials, I don't know, millennials are still stuck with traditional ideas of what it means to work, maybe like a 9-to-5, maybe liking their work. But I don't know, maybe that's proclivity toward capitalism, right? Then maybe that's
entrepreneurial. Gen Y is really entrepreneurial, yeah.
Yeah, very much so. So I don't know, maybe that comes from an inability to unattach themselves from capitalism, but in Gen Z is very critical of capitalism, and they're just working to, you know, make enough money to do their passions. So I think that's completely different. That all feeds into it.
I'm trying to think about the difference between Y and Z. They're both very accepting of diversity. They don't really care what color your skin is or your sexual orientation. They are very internet savvy, obviously. Why was Q accused of being fragile teacups, anxious, couldn't cope with stress because they had helicopter parents? But I don't hear that so much for Z. But there is increasing rates of anxiety and depression, especially for girls. So you could say anxiety is also a trend. And it is, that's definitely a fact. And I wonder if you have observations of why. Why would especially girls be more anxious recently?
So I watch a lot of TikTok. I love TikTok.
I have dances on TikTok. I have to show you ballroom dances.
Oh, okay. You post them yourself?
But my dance teacher posted them. Yeah.
Incredible. Yeah, I'd love to see them.
They're really fun. Like East Coast, West Coast, waltz, that kind of a thing.
I love it. Yeah, please send me. I love TikToks, and I have one for my cat. I'm trying to make him TikTok famous. Well, on TikTok, there's this trend going around, which is really, really interesting to me, where girls are posting images and videos of their bodies, in which they show like a flat belly, and then they show a fuller, rounder belly on the same person, and the caption usually reads something like, bodies that look like this also look like this. And it's supposed to be, it's supposed to show that, you know, the same body type can have different fluctuating images to it. So if you see, for example, an image of a fit looking person on social media and they have, you know, like waterboard abs or all of these muscles showing and stuff, but then you can also see if they relax their posture or something, you know, their belly may protrude, and that's not usually shown in social media. So the TikTok trend is meant to put an end to that and kind of help you change your thinking a little bit and show you a different perspective. There are also videos where the girls who are posting these videos are posting this little, like, I'm going to model myself, but, you know, like, this area, usually it's, like, rounder women. And if, even if you have, like, a flat tummy, this area usually protrudes a little bit from the pubic bone. The pubic bone is flatter. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, so girls on TikTok and on social media, I've seen that they are worrying about this, and they're just like, well, why am I fat in this one area? And then people are going around and explaining that that's not fat. That's where your uterus is situated, and that's what it takes. So it has to protrude that way. So it's really interesting. These are really great ways to showcase different body types and celebrate them. And the reception to these videos, it's huge, because girls everywhere are resonating with them, me, myself, and I included. I'm very thankful for those, because I've had questions about this exact same thing. My friends have too. So I guess that said, there's a lot of opportunity for comparison, right? We see images of quote-unquote perfect content all over social media. There are perfect bodies, perfect partners, perfect socialized, perfect everything. So it consumes us. It makes us feel inadequate. And we have tried to get there so many, we have tried to get to this image of perfection so many times, and we've failed, quote-unquote failed. So I don't know. I think that's where the anxiety and depression come in. Social media is a big part of it. Images that we present and put out. So these challenges, they're really challenging the way that we're thinking about ourselves, at least on TikTok.
What about boys? I mean, they have pressure to be tall, not short, buff, not overweight, but they don't seem to have the same rates of anxiety and depression.
Yeah, you're right. Maybe that's because boys aren't really taught to express their feelings or be vocal about their feelings. Maybe when these surveys are going out, maybe they don't even know that they're experiencing these feelings because they can't put a label on them. So I don't have an answer to that, but it is a big, you're right, it is a big issue. Masculinity in general is a big issue. It's not really dissected enough, is it?
It seems to see what you think of this. I think another reason for anxiety and depression is there are so many pressures to get into a good college, to have AP courses, to do well in your SATs, and you know you're going to graduate with $30,000 in debt, so you've got to have a good job to pay for your debt, and there's more students applying for the same number of colleges. It's much harder to get in. It's just a lot of pressure for college-bound young people, and for kids who aren't college-bound, they don't have the industrial making a car kind of jobs available that they had in the past to make money. So there's pressure on them. How am I going to make money? Do you think that's a factor as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a huge factor. It makes all the sense in the world too, because I think it also lines up with that, with the fact that 60% of women, that 60% fact with the women in college that you referenced earlier, right? It makes sense to me. It all feeds into each other. I remember growing up.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Gail. I had to cut that short a little bit. This is your groovy grandma. I have a new name. I went on vacation and someone suggested I go by DJ Double G, groovy grandma. I like it. I like it a lot. Okay. It is peanut butter jelly time. You are listening to FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. I'm trying to celebrate. Well, let's do the peanut butter jelly one first. Let's get
that going. It's peanut butter jelly time. Peanut butter
I'm
jelly
so sorry.
Time. Peanut butter jelly time. Way up, way up, way up, way up. Now there you go. There you go. There you go. There you go. Peanut butter jelly. Peanut butter jelly. Peanut butter jelly. Peanut butter jelly. Let's do the peanut butter jelly. Peanut butter jelly.
Peanut butter jelly with the baseball bat.
Peanut butter.
the opinions voiced